Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. So whenever I have guests on, I always try to play age-appropriate music, and joining me today is a retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General Paul K. Van Riper. So are you a Stones fan?
No. In fact, you'd have had to go back to the mid-50s. You get back in Elvis and some of that era before you hit my music.
All right. Well, next time I'll remember that.
50s on 5 when you listen to satellite radio. That's what I'm tuned to.
50s on 5. You know what? I know that because those numbers, they go 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And there you go. First of all, so thanks for doing this. I've been looking forward to it, and the email I've received since I announced it, so are a lot of other people. Appreciate you coming on and being the first installment of a series that we'll do here on All Marine Radio entitled On Discipline. So thank you very much. First question, let's talk about a little bit about your career before we talk about discipline. Born and raised where?
I was born in Brownsville, Pennsylvania, about 35 miles south of Pittsburgh. I lived most of my life, young life, in suburbs of Pittsburgh, a little town called Dormont. And then in 1956, I enlisted in the local Marine Corps Reserve. This was long before we had the 4th Division. And there was an association. There simply were units in town. So this was the 12th Infantry Battalion, U.S. MCR.
How did the Marine Corps get on your radar, sir?
When I was about 12 years old, I have a twin brother. He's also a Marine. Mm-hmm. We went with her dad and mom one night. She was going to do some grocery shopping. While she was in the store, my dad was in the front seat, and a newspaper boy came up and sold my dad a paper. He opened it up across the steering wheel, and he said, boys, the war in Korea is going to be over pretty soon. We said, why is that, Dad? He said, they're sending in the Marines. And, of course, that raised a lot of questions. Who are the Marines? And he had been too old for World War II, but he had this view of, I think, the stereotypical view of Marines and what they'd accomplished during World War II. So he began to tell us all about it and intrigued our interest. And, of course, in the 50s, you were subject to the draft, and both my brother and I decided we wanted to enlist, and so we enlisted in local reserve, went off to boot camp in the fall of 1956.
So you go off to boot camp, and you become a reservist, but obviously you attend college. Where did you go to school?
Well, after recruit training, and we had some fantastic drill instructors, none more than Donald Neff. He's a retired master sergeant now, and I still stay in touch with him. In fact, at the 40th anniversary, not to the day, but of the year of my graduation from recruit training at Parris Island, I reviewed a graduation parade, and to my left was standing retired Marine Donald C. Neff. He set me off on a straight and narrow. I always say what my mom and dad taught me and what then Staff Sergeant Neff taught me put me in good stead. So when both my brother and when we came back, we enrolled in college, but right from the outset, we had the goal of trying to gain a commission. And so we stayed in the reserve while we were going to school, and then it took a while. We had to work our way through school. So we came back and were commissioned in 1963.
So where did you go to school?
I went to a small college in a little town, again, south of Pittsburgh called California.
Right.
And it was called then California State College. Since it's been called the University of California in Pennsylvania. So you can imagine the confusion that has. But my brother went to the University of Pittsburgh, and I quite honestly thought I got a better education because the professors would often... come out of the classroom, go to the snack bar, continue the discussions, where he had largely graduate assistants teaching most of his courses, and we were getting it from the real experts.
Talk to us about your career, sir. So you And I want to kind of, if you could give us a thumbnail sketch of your career, and then I want to come back and relate and begin the discussion about discipline. So give everybody, some people who may not know you, believe that or not, a thumbnail of your career in the Marine Corps.
I always considered myself a Marine first, but I was in the infantry from the time I got the MOS out of boot camp all the way until the time I became a general officer. So I served in all three Marine divisions. I saw combat on five different occasions. First of all, in the Dominican Republic during the rebellion, the 2nd Marine Division, we went and engaged in that. And then I was an advisor to the Vietnamese Marine Corps, was wounded and evacuated into another assignment, went back as a company commander for my company, 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines. And then I had the opportunity to serve with the United Nations, their peacekeeping force in Palestine. Saw a lot of action up in southern Lebanon, obviously not involved in it, but as an observer in the middle of it, trying to separate the PLO from Israelis and so forth. And then Desert Shield, Desert Storm. The served overseas, Okinawa, in the Middle East, a number of deployments to the Med, sort of the typical career. I was active duty for more than almost 35 years.
And then how did you end your career, sir?
I was the commanding general at Quantico, the Combat Development Command, which was a great assignment. The officers who had set that thing up to do combat development had put together a fantastic organization, and obviously it was like driving a well-engineered, finely tuned race car. It was a great organization.
Now, for those of us on active duty, at the time, you were. If somebody were to say discipline to me, I would have this instantaneous, automatic response that I would say Ben Riper. And you became a legend in the late 80s and the 90s for your devotion to discipline. And combine that with your shaved head, and you were a fairly intimidating guy. I'll confess right up front, I did not understand it, and I was part of a large group of people that didn't get it until later when I heard Colonel Zinni at the time speak, and then subsequent to that, I began to understand more. Talk to me and explain to everybody, where does your devotion to the subject of discipline begin in your career?
Well, it actually begins in recruit training with the gentleman I mentioned before, Staff Sergeant Neff. There was a Staff Sergeant, Dave Johnson, who was on the I&I staff in our reserve unit. And he kind of took my brother and I when we were Lance Corporals under his wing and schooled us in the ins and outs of being a leader in the Marine Corps. And I always recall him telling us that the same Marine who gets drunk, comes back into the squad bay and trips over a locker box and raises hell, is the same one that's most likely to give away an ambush in combat. And he kept telling us there's what you do in peacetime directly reflects what you're going to do in wartime. And this myth of the screw-up in peacetime suddenly becoming the hero when combat comes is just that, a myth. It's so extraordinary that we do remember the handful of soldiers and Marines that might have done something like that. But there is a direct relationship. I saw it a number of places, but probably most spectacularly when I was a company commander in Vietnam and what happened in the first couple of firefights we were in. So if I could just illustrate,
if you could frame it, sir, because Vietnam is one of the things about hosting this program that I've learned probably the most about is Vietnam, and it was so different depending on where you were geographically and what year you were there. So could you just frame for us what year were you there twice? Could you frame what years you were there and then where you were?
I was there in 1965, wounded in early 66, 7th February, and evacuated back to the States. Once I recovered in the Philadelphia Naval Hospital, I went to the basic school, was a staff platoon commander for 3 platoons, and then taught in company tactics. So in terms of being prepared for combat, I'd already been seasoned in the Dominican Republic. I'd had the experience with the Vietnamese Marines, taught company tactics, then went through what was amphibious warfare school, so I had a pretty good handle on staff actions.
And where were you? Then, where did you get wounded, sir? What part of Vietnam?
I was with a unit, this Vietnamese unit, and an airborne unit. We did a hell of an assault on a VC camp south of Saigon. And I was shot in the stomach, destroyed my spleen, and had to have my intestine sewed up. Lucky as could be, because the bullet went out between the ribs. I've still got a scar in the back of my back between these ribs. It looks like a bullet sideways.
Okay, all right. Continue. So you wind up at the basic school teaching, and that kind of completes your preparation to go a second time.
Go a second time. I go from there to amphibious warfare school. So, there could not have been better preparation for being a company commander. So we're in one of our first firefights, and a squadron gets wounded, and he's laying down in a corner of our rice paddy, and we're trying to get a medevac for him, but the Marines are trying to find the important pieces of equipment or gear that he has. They're looking for the map. Where's his compass? Where's his shackle sheet with the codes on it? And if you ever just counted the pockets in your utilities, in your flak jacket, the possibility it might be in his pack, or he might have stuck in his helmet. It took a while to figure where this stuff was. And I said to myself, why doesn't every unit leader carry the stuff in the same place? So we wound up, the map was in the left cargo pocket. The compass was on the right side of your harness. It had an air panel up underneath your helmet liner. So every key piece of gear, we knew where it was. Somebody's wounded, right away you pick it up and go. Then we had a firefight, and I said, throw a yellow smoke. Came back, don't have any yellow smoke. Throw a green smoke, don't have a green smoke. Well, what the hell do you have? And I said, this is done. And we ran out of ammunition. So I sat down with the platoon commander and said, we're going to have a standard of what we're going to carry and where we're going to carry it. And so I'll have a feel. You know, if, for example, each squad has two yellow, two green, two red smokes, I'll know when we're getting low after I give you instructions or I see it happening on the battlefield. And if we got 3,000 rounds and 7.62 for the M60 machine gun, I'll kind of have a feel when we're getting low on ammo. And that's what we did. And the first thing that happens is when you're getting ready to go on an operation, the platoon commander stands in front. He looks across the squad leaders and he sees three compasses right in the same place. He doesn't have to walk up to each squad. You got a compass? Where is it? No, he sees it. And so it was what I call that good order and discipline and uniformity. Now, that's not uniformity for uniformity's sake. That's uniformity for a purpose. Now, you can go the extreme on this. One of the examples I thought was kind of foolish. Some unit leaders usually get excited about whether you put your boot lace left over right or right over left. I said, who cares? The boot's laced up. That's uniformity for uniformity. The only reason for it is for a purpose. And I don't think in my career, I ever asked somebody to meet a standard if there wasn't a purpose behind it.
But, you know, well, and we'll talk about this here in a little bit, sir, but you know where that goes, though, right? All of a sudden you're the character of the whole concept of, oh, this is all chicken shit, and we who fought know what's really important and things like that. And so when you come back from your company command tour, in terms of your thoughts about discipline, you proof this stuff and it's solid in your head based on the lessons you saw that being disciplined in combat saves lives?
Absolutely. And if anybody has any doubt, any of the one who's whatever amount of combat they claim these days, tell them to come to one of my company's reunions. We have them every other year. We're going to have one this August. And talk to those Marines that I was privileged to command and see what they say about that kind of discipline. They tell, and some of them have the same sort of reaction when I first went in and began tightening them up, that this was chicken shit type stuff. And they soon realize, hey, we're a good outfit, and we're a good outfit because we do these things. And they still get together, let's say, every 2 years and proud as can be of their service in Vietnam.
And so where did Mike 3-7 fight? And you went back, that was in 1968, yes?
Yeah, we were on Hill 55, Hill 10, Hill 37. All these are 10, 15 miles west of Da Nang. And it was we had a lot of heavy combat. Generally, we were close to their table of organization of 200. We'd range from after combat, we might be down in the 170s. Generally, though, we were up around 200 Marines. Now, in the 10 months I had the company, to give you an order of magnitude of the kind of combat we're in, we had 100% casualties across those 200. That's obviously a lot of Marines that went the whole year without getting wounded, but then there were those who came, and there was short time and got wounded, so the ins and outs, it was over 100%, 74 of which were KIAs. So I don't want to hear from too many folks about what combat's like and what close combat is like, because there aren't that many, and I've had the duty's only way to express it, to personally kill Viet Cong. So, you talk about close and the destroy, I got a pretty good idea what it's all about.
Well, you know, sir, it's real interesting. Before we came on air, we were talking about that's really the last time we had an enemy that would mortar you, that would use artillery, and would close with you. Since then, you know, we've had people lay down in front of us, but, you know, they haven't closed with us. Mm-hmm. And we fought essentially an insurgency with IEDs and guys who know our ROE, know where our QRFs are, and they play this ROE game. We have not fought an opponent since you fought it. Since you fought one that would close with us and come to put our head on the stick. We have not done that in low all these years. So I think your thoughts and your peers' thoughts about what discipline is are a little bit different because of your experience. And now when we talk peer-to-peer contest, I think your thoughts are as important as ever and probably something we should go down. I want to ask you a road that we should go down. I want to ask you, before we talk about your time in the 2nd Division, I saw a headline relative to this whole discussion, and since you were head of the Marine Corps University, you can comment on this. Is it a sad comment when an officer would write, "General, stick to strategy," about General Furness's intent relative to the 2nd Division?
Yes, I won't get into a definition of strategy, but for a general of a division is not dealing in strategy. He's got to be certainly cognizant of what strategic thought is and what strategic goals, but at best he's high-level tactics or dealing in operational art. But I would agree with the comment, but with this proviso. Anything that is found wrong with the way things should be, according to Marine Corps standards, above the grade of corporal, means that somebody is, that some corporals failed. Or if the division commander is saying this, a corporal, a sergeant, all of your staff NCOs, your company grading, your field grade officers have failed. When I was in the division and I'd find trash laying out right in the middle in front of a battalion headquarters, why in the hell should the division commander find that? Where was every Marine that walked by, corporal and above, that didn't do something about it? And it's the same with a dirty rifle. Whatever it is. So those telling the general to stick to it, that's correct. Do your jobs, and he can stick to operational art and high-level tactics.
All right, let's talk about you. So you go to the 2nd Division, and you are and you put out this guidance. Did you put out this guidance on day one? And the three documents I'm looking at are your philosophy of leadership, words of advice to subordinates, and what will become known as the 21 rules, but the subject is specific requirements or 21 rules. Did you have those things ready to go, and were they issued soon after your assumption of command, or were these things that you developed after you had assumed command?
No, yes, and all three of them were the final results of command from battalion, regiment, the Marine barracks. I was fortunate to have a number of commands. And as a battalion commander, I made a few notes, and then I would, with experience, I would expand or modify them. And so when I knew I was going to be assigned the division, I sat down and wrote those. Now, the 21 rules were specific in terms of what I was seeing, not just in the 2nd Division, but around the Marine Corps.
Right.
But that's not unusual. The same thing happened after Korea. The same thing happened after Vietnam. And we saw the same thing after Desert Storm. And I imagine what the Marine Corps is saying now is not unexpected in relation to that. People come back from war and kind of feel that, we don't have to live up to these standards. And it's just wrong. It's just the way, it's sort of a natural phenomena. And somebody's got to bite the bullet and tighten it up. The first two documents were refined versions. The 21 rules, a couple of those things I had before, but it was my general observations and what was happening across the Marine Corps. Certainly not an indictment of any particular unit or previous commanders. It was widespread.
So it's interesting because one of the interesting parts of this whole discussion is the kind of institutional ebb and flow as, you know, the senior lance corporal comes back from combat and say, yeah, all this stuff's chicken shit. And what's interesting in today's Marine Corps is we don't shine boots anymore. Or, you know, Marines don't shine boots anymore. You don't press your utilities. They come out of the dryer and you snap them once. You put your rank insignia on and off you go. So there's less and less required of Marines. I think that this institutional thing about going into a conflict and then coming out of a conflict, the way we view discipline, and then that part of, because there was an awful long time between the end of Vietnam and the start of Desert Storm and for the Marine Corps. And I know because I served in that period of time where, General Smith and the 8th Marines were the only people doing anything in the Marine Corps. And that's why we all hated the 8th Marine Regiment, because they were the only ones getting any ribbons and badges going around. But the rest of us lived in that peacetime Marine Corps devoted to MNU, Irish penance, and inspections, and did not realize how good that served us until it was our turn to go, and we knew the exacting nature of what the Marine Corps required, and we'd been taught it that way. So to me, the institution does go through that ebb and flow. And can you talk about what was it like, you know, as a Marine officer in the 70s when the Marine Corps went through this as well?
Well, the Marine Corps reached a low point probably of the entire history coming out of Vietnam, because you had discipline problems, you had race problems, you had alcohol problems, you had drug problems. And you were trying to solve all of these things that are societal ills, and at the same time rebuild the basic skills in the force. So it was, there are several things that I could indicate to the manifestations of the problem. When I went into 1st Battalion 8th Marines, I was the ops officer, S3, the Battalion XO had just required all of the platoon commanders to turn in their handcuffs. Why handcuffs? Because Marines got out of control, they had to handcuff them. He collected 35 sets of handcuffs in the battalion. The division every night had a company on riot control duty. They were simply to respond to riots among the troops. When I was a platoon commander, the officer of the day carried a sword. It was just ceremonial. We all carried 45s during this period, and on occasion they were needed to control things. Good order and discipline had just gone out the window. And without the good order and discipline, you can't even begin to develop the combat skills, which is the whole purpose of the Marine Corps' existence.
So you go through that, and now in 1991, you become the division commander of the 2nd Marine Division. And talk about, as you put this guidance out, what was the response to it? Did people buy it right away? Did people look at you and did some of the similar strains of the discussion go on like they are going on today? The story about the 2nd Marine Division, General Furness, has been above the fold on the Marine Corps Times website for easily a week, I think. And then before that, there was the story that preceded that. So the only reason that story stays there is if it gets clicked on, because we all know how things work these days. Were you surprised at the response, or talk to us about the response you got as you put that out?
I was, yes. In fact, what's interesting is I began to see some of these complaints, and then I saw a couple references to what I'd done as if I'd done it different and what I did was right. I did the exact same damn thing that he did. no difference than what Dave has done. And I had the same reaction, but you didn't have the sort of spotlight media you have now, or obviously with the social media, things didn't fly around. These were letters to editors, complaints to the local newspaper. So they were back column. It was probably the most notoriety was a column in the Armed Forces Journal, which was a professional, well, pretty widespread magazine at the time. And it kind of surprised me. I thought, this is all basic stuff. This is what Staff Sergeant Neff was teaching me. This is what Staff Sergeant Johnson taught me. And I would really get irritated, angry, when I'd be out for a run at noontime, and I see things like standing lights on, or I see trash laying around. And I developed this policy of, if I see something amiss outside of your barracks, you have an immediate free inspection. So I'd be running, and I'd see something that was, I'm not talking about a few scraps of paper, I'm talking about actual trash and garbage laying around, stacks of it. So I'd go in the barracks, and without fail, every time I went inside of a barracks that was a mess outside, it was a mess inside. Racks weren't made, trash cans were overflowing inside, the water running in the heads, lights left on. And it's the same thing with individual Marines. I found in the days when we did shine brass and shine boots, if I stepped in front of a Marine, his brass wouldn't shine, his rifle was dirty. There was always a direct connection. So I was irritated that corporals and sergeants and right up the chain of command weren't doing their duty. I wanted to spend my time on the issues that general officers and division commanders could spend their time, not on what is really, really Lance Corporal and Corporal business.
So as this thing unfolds, right, and again, it's unfolded in a very similar way in terms of it's kind of exploded, right? And now with social media being more powerful and you have things like, Terminal Lance out there and that, it immediately gets on that and then on the other bulletin boards. It's almost one of the things that I've been, just as kind of an observer, and I have, both my sons are Marines, and so we have interesting discussions about it, is that it's almost like there's this indignant response about how dare you. Our culture has changed a lot since the culture that went to Vietnam. I mean, those kids were still, they were raised tough. Kids are not raised the same way in our culture. And if you look at the stories out of the special forces community is dealing with relative to different trials that they court martials that they have going on, if you look at the events that the Navy deals with, particularly in the 7th Fleet, to me, which is a lot of poor discipline out there and a lack of professionalism, you see these strains, and our ability to look inward to me is almost at issue here. I'm curious of your thoughts about the culture that exists today and how much of our culture can the Marine Corps absorb and still locate, close with, and destroy, whether it be the Russians, the Chinese, or anybody else. What are your thoughts on how culture impacts this and our ability to have measured, articulate discourse on the subject?
Well, let's take the combat skills first. I'm convinced the Marine Corps has never had the sort of talent, the high level of training at small unit level right up through major units that it has today. I recall I would see a Marine working on a sand table or something out of 29 palms. And in the back of my mind, what I see him doing, I think, those are a couple of lieutenants that are working this out. And I'd go up and it would be two corporals. So the responsibility has gone down to the more junior ranks, and they handle it well. They have a skill level that my generation didn't even come close to in terms of weapons and tactics and understanding the profession of arms. And most of them have at least heard that what you do in garrison can't be different than what you do in combat. So if you believe in mission-type tactics in combat, you can't have a rigid top-down, follow my orders in garrison. You have to have a mission-type orders in garrison. But for some reason, they can't connect that to the things we're talking about, and that's the state of your barracks, the state of your uniform, what your vehicles look like, what your weapons look like. Because, you know, the examples I've used have all been cleanliness and trash and, right. and so forth. But I'd go into armories, and I'd find the same sort of difficulties in army in the armories with weapons that hadn't been turned in for maintenance, with weapons that had been deadlined for months. I haven't seen machine guns that have been deadlined for 6 months, and nobody's doing anything about it. No reason a division commander should ever find something like that. So the culture is, on one side, I think it's good. It's just trying to get the connection between what, for any better words, are good order and discipline and everything the Marines do on a day-to-day basis.
And it seems like a structure is also something that you know, people look at and they're like, are you kidding me? That you should be in. I was going over your 21 rules. And talk about your, it's interesting, my son, my oldest, just left the basic school as a SPC and as an instructor and whatnot, and so he's headed down to Fort Benning to go to school. And so we were talking, and I said, hey, if I could give you one piece of advice, he looked at me and he said, yeah. Now, mind you, I'm his father who doesn't know anything, but.
No, our son's, he's a colonel now, but I've been through the whole thing from second lieutenant on.
And so I said, inspect. And he said, he just looked at me, and I said, if you inspect it, they'll give it to you. Right? And they're blank canvas, and what you define for them, and what you inspect, they will absolutely give you. And that whole expect what you inspect is absolutely the most spot-on advice ever for a commander. And so I'm curious, in those rules, you know, rooms were getting inspected on a daily basis. So explain that whole, you know, inspection thing for people that don't understand it.
Well, let me see. If you don't inspect, things begin to come apart. Even your staff NCOs and sometimes, unfortunately, officers will take shortcuts. We're getting ready to do a crest hike, and I'm walking through. I'm going to walk through to make sure all the Marines got the kind of gear we're supposed to have. And I see this staff sergeant whose pack looks particularly squared away. I open it up in his damn box. He put a box in the pack. Nothing's supposed to have. Well, where was the platoon commander? Where was the company commander? Why the hell is the battalion commander? Did I find a staff NCO with a box when he's supposed to have the prescribed gear? So you obviously don't inspect from top to bottom every single Marine, but you've got to inspect enough that people understand what your standards are and know that they're not going to skate.
So at the squad level, one of the things that I read was that rooms ought to be inspected on a daily basis. I think most Marines that hear that would hear that now would say, "Are you crazy?"
If you don't, if somebody doesn't look in there, pretty soon racks aren't made, trash isn't taken out, contraband is brought in, all kinds of things happen. You know?
Interesting. Interesting. Is there any part of this discussion on discipline that you found more interesting than any other part, sir?
No, like I said before, it's deja vu. I've been through it now post-Korea because I came in right after the Korean War, saw it after Vietnam, saw it after Desert Shield, Desert Storm. So it's just the fourth cycle of it. And, you know, of course, after each of the previous cycles, I thought, well, we've learned from this and we'll never have it again. It's just the nature of things. When you come out of combat, there's a tendency not to want to get back to what are the basics of good order and discipline.
So give people some advice. So we've seen what General Furness has put out. We've heard all the hoopla that surrounds it. If you're a company commander, a battalion commander, give them some advice from somebody who's done it in wartime, in peacetime, done it over the course of decades. How do we look inward? What are the things that you would do? Were you in a similar situation? And we're hearing this kind of advice from a major general for the first time. How would you handle it?
I would talk to those corporals and sergeants and say, I want you to be part of the solution. I don't want you to be the problem. I want to do what generals are educated and have the experience to do. And that's, they say, Howard tactics, think about the future plans, think about training of large units. They shouldn't be out there doing the most basic corporal and sergeant type duties. So help me out. Be a part of the solution. Don't be a problem for me. And if I'm finding this kind of stuff, then you're not doing what you're supposed to do, your duties, and it's gravitating all the way to the top. And, of course, every staff NCO, every company grade officer, and every field grade officer in between that corporal sergeant and the major general ought to kind of slide down in the chair embarrassed that they're not providing the supervision for those young NCOs.
I want to ask you a question that's come up on this program, and that is often the subject of the fact that we've seemingly emasculated our staff NCOs. That when the Marine Corps I came into in 1983, the staff NCOs were pissed because, I want to say, the Commandant put out in Almar that if you assign somebody EMI, right, go dig a fighting position, go dig a mortar pit, a machine gun position, right, you had to periodically throughout the course of the day go out and check on them. And they were pissed about that. Like, what is the world coming to, right? Why do I got to go out and waste my time and check on them, right? Which today I don't think we even do that anymore. And then all the tools that staff NCOs, who are the foremen of the Marine Corps, and the NCOs who are likewise, they are the people that get it done, that shove it through, that crack the whip and make things happen. They are the tools that they've used historically have been taken away, and I don't mean physical punishment, but now that you can assign them an essay, which you know is the equivalent of what a grammar school teacher would do in terms of discipline. Have we emasculated? You know, I mean, the whole issue of yelling, right? You know, you yelled at me. You're hazing me. Thoughts on that?
I got some sympathy, but not a lot.
Okay.
I was, as a young officer, was what you call a screamer. I would raise my voice, chew butt unmercifully. I found out as I got a little bit more senior that there were other better ways to do it. Many times a Marine is embarrassed when you find something, and just that embarrassment will cause him to get corrected. I can't tell you, since I've been retired now more than 20 years, and I've run into a Marine, I'll be up at Quantico, down at Camp Lejeune, or one of these Marines from a rifle company from Vietnam, will say, "Sir, do you remember when?" I have absolutely no recollection, but it's something I discipline them for, I counsel them on, that stuck with them all these years because it had such an impact. And then I begin to reflect, when a captain said something to me and I was a young Lance Corporal, I still remember what they said. So there's more of an effect than you might think with good counseling. And some of the things we did in the past actually were hazing and, of course, led to unnecessary injuries and just weren't appropriate type leadership. And when they talk about the old Corps, in particular, they're thinking about the days right after Korea, right after Vietnam, you didn't have the same quality of across the board of Marines you have today. You had great Marines, but not across the board. There were more discipline problems, a lot more folks without education. But my first platoon, only one Marine had a high school education. So they're better educated. It's an all-volunteer force. There's no threat of a draft, so it's a true all-volunteer force. And some of these techniques that they've heard about, most of them haven't really experienced it. Maybe they were needed in those days, but with the force we have today, I don't think some of the more far-out ones are ones we should countenance.
Okay, so this is kind of the general question. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about this subject that you think is really important to know? As Marines, take kind of what I hope is a grown-up, mature discipline on the role, a grown-up, mature view of the subject of discipline and how integral it is to our life and in particular, whether it is in garrison, whether you're out in the field operating, or whether you're actually getting ready or going to war, what haven't I been smart enough to ask you without which this discussion isn't complete?
I would go back to say, what is the fundamental truth? The fundamental truth is you do not want any difference between what you do in garrison and what you do in wartime. You want mission type orders in garrison. You want mission type orders in combat. You want strict adherence to standards and uniformity that have a purpose, not just to look good, not for appearances, but have meaning in peacetime and in wartime. So in peacetime, there's a reason that you keep your gear squared away. There's a reason you keep your room squared away, because you're supposed to do the same with your combat equipment. If you go into a combat zone and Marines behave like they do in peacetime, throwing this stuff around, it destroys the camouflage. You know, dig a foxhole, put camel paint on their face, and then leave some trash laying around that can be seen for yards. So they've got to be the same. We used to, in the old days when first we were introducing computers, the ones in garrison were in white containers, and the ones for the field were green, a green shell. And we used to talk about white gear and green gear. Well, then somebody realized, no, the form, the function, the feel for what you do in garrison ought to be the same as what you do in combat. So the same machines we used in the garrison environment begin to be the same ones we used in the field. So there just is no dividing line between the two.
When you think about what you say was the misunderstanding in a lot of ways of the term is chicken shit discipline, and you said earlier in the interview that it's not discipline for the sake of merely appearance discipline. It is functional discipline that contributes to organizational discipline that makes you a better warfighting unit, that translates to less casualties in combat. Is that the thing that irritates you the most when people talk about what you tried to do with the 2nd Marine Division in 1991?
Yes, and what irritates me now is this reference that it wasn't like that. It's not like that in the old Corps. I'm 81 years old. If you're more than 81, I'll listen to you about what it was like in the old days. But if you're not, then your old Corps was my new Corps, and it's not what's not the way you're describing it. Things aren't quite like you envisioned they might have been. That irritates me, I guess, when I hear that. The other thing is, there are things on that list that people might question. One of the ones was why I didn't want to see Marines walking around licking an ice cream cone. But in the post-Vietnam era, Marines outwardly didn't seem to display the pride that I had experienced back in the 50s. So to try to illustrate this, before I took battalion command, I got a photo of a so-called horse Marine from China. Many of us have seen it. He's standing at a modified parade rest with a sword in front of him, the tip on the ground, and he has this look of confidence. It's not arrogance. It's just solid confidence. And I would write on, I got the picture reproduced, and I had a bunch of them. And whenever I would see a Marine that exhibited anything like that, I would sign it to a Marine who exhibits the competence and confidence of this Marine, of the China Marines. And it became almost like an award. Marines really wanted this. In fact, I'd every once in a while an officer would be leaving the battalion. He said, "Sir, I know the battalion commander didn't intend these photos for the officers, but could you autograph one for me?" And so I would. And so then I see Marines strolling along, hands in their pocket, eating an ice cream cone. Now, technically, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's just the idea that you're not exhibiting the pride. You're supposed to, not out of uniform, I could care less. It's the fact that they were doing that in uniform that sort of destroys the image that we want to portray of a professional force. So there were things like that, and there's other things on that list that you can immediately see why you wouldn't do them.
You know, in your memorandum number one of 1991 to the division staff, regimental, and separate battalions, under the subject as philosophy of leadership, paragraph one. My first and foremost charge to you is to maintain an environment which allows our officers and non-commissioned officers to lead properly. And then this is underlined from the gentleman who sent it to me, the Marine officer who sent it to me. This environment has and must remain one in which all have a strong sense that being a Marine is a special calling, not an occupation or a job. And that's exactly what you just discussed.
Right. I remember reading a book when I was younger about what made the German Army the kind of a quality force it was, for, you know, not the German government, but the German Army that we all look back. And the answer was that every German soldier cared what every other German soldier did. And I think that would be even more so with the Marine. Every Marine ought to care what every other Marine does. So if you're in an airport and you see a Marine out of uniform, which is unusual, you won't just let it pass by. You'll correct that Marine. And it's the overall impression. And when I talk to members of the other services, which I do quite frequently, that's the thing they marvel at, is across the board how even our discipline is and how consistent it is.
Somebody emailed me a question to ask you, so I want to. It's appropriate as we wind this thing down to ask it now. Mac, when you get General Van Riper on, I'm curious about something you said about a week ago. You said, given the state of our culture today, it takes more courage for a young person to look at the Marine Corps and say, I want a piece of that, than it did in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, or even the 90s. That the cultural divide has grown. The values of the Marine Corps are so different now than much of our culture, not all of it, but much of it, that it does take more moral courage on the part of a young person to look at the Marine Corps and say, I want a piece of that. Do you think, and this is my question, if you could ask the general, that if we don't uphold those standards, that Marines are actually disappointed when they come in, that it isn't the way they thought it would be, and that the change doesn't really need to be forever. It can only be while I'm at work during part of the day, and they can go back to being the way they were and exhibit those behaviors when discipline is an important part of our life.
So the answer is there's two parts. Yes, in terms of is it a challenge? It is for a lot of reasons. One, is our society so much different? A large portion of those who enlisted in the Marine Corps and were commissioned came from the farms, they came from the factories, they came from a generation that had endured hardship, going clear back to the Depression and the wars. They were used to people being sick. Many families were 6, 7 children. It was not unusual for one or two of those children to die, either in some sort of an accident at work or of disease. And now they're in families of 1 and 2 children, and it's very unusual to hear of somebody, a young person, perishing. So, and some of the physical jobs that were in the past no longer exist. So from that, what they're going to face, the physical challenges, the hardships in the Marine Corps, it's going to be a little more difficult for them. On the other side, those who came to the colors then always had the draft hanging over them. So were they true volunteers? What would they have done? I mean, I have to even go back to myself. What would I have done if I hadn't known there was a draft? Would I have said, I'll just go to college and I'll do something else? Today, they are true volunteers. So you have both sides of it. It's going to be more challenging for them, but their motivation is purer than you could say for across the board for those who enlisted prior to the all-volunteer force.
Do you think by not adhering to that standard that it is a major disappointment to them professionally?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm surprised at this, but I've had run into Marines who say that boot camp was too easy. And I don't think it's any bravado. I think they really, the stories about boot camp were such that they didn't think that the it lived up to those stories.
Interesting. So to close this out, again, thank you for coming on and talking about this, and I think this is a great way to kick off what I hope is a deep discussion about discipline throughout the course of the Marine Corps. General Furness has kind of lit it off, but I know there's tremendous in interest in it, because on a daily basis, I people reach out to me either expressing their interest in these interviews or just a general thought about the discussion. So thank you very much for doing this, and bring us up to date. What are you doing these days, and what have you become?
Well, I've become an old man, but is that thing, I think it was Clint Eastwood, I don't let the old man in. So I'm still in pretty good health. My wife, unfortunately, is not, so I find myself spending a lot of time with her, either going to doctors or caring for her. But I spend a lot of time reading. I read professional things, particularly history, military history. I find myself reading a lot of things about faith and theology. And I always go back to what's in one of those documents you referenced, where I share with Marines that there are four important things in most of our lives. And that, of course, is our country, our friends, family, and our faith. And then while we're in the Corps and ever afterwards, the Corps. On most days, all of those four things are in balance. You don't have any problems. But when you are challenged by something that makes you think, well, which one of these is more important? I tell them if the Corps ever asks you to do something that's wrong for the nation, you simply don't do it. You understand the Constitution is for the nation. It's not the Corps. If the nation ever asks you to do something that goes against your faith, you simply don't do it. Because the order of priority when it's necessary is on the bottom is the Corps, then your country, then your family and friends, and right at the top is your faith. And I think anybody that's been in combat knows that. And certainly as you age, you'll become more inclined to appreciate it.
All right. Give me a leadership book to read.
What would I read?
Give me something interesting relative to leadership that you've read recently.
Well, I'm going to have to look the title up for you, but there's a gentleman who reached out to me. He does some of the similar things you're doing, and he's just written a new book that I had a look at that really impressed me. First, it was well written, it was practical, and it was on how to take initiative. If it's not that, I go back to the original handbook for officers that S.L.A. Marshall wrote. It was printed for years. When I was on active duty, they did a rewrite with a different author. It never met the previous standard, and I believe it's been rewritten once since then. But it's S.L.A. Marshall book on how to being an officer. That's probably the one I'd go back to.
All right. And then, how about a book on faith or theology that you'd recommend that anybody read?
Well, this course, depending on your religion that you base your faith on, would be different. For me, it's a book on Jesus, and it's called Biography, and it's a combining of both a biography and theology. And what the authors maintain is that there have been a number of books written on Jesus about the biography of his life. There have been many others written about the theology that he preached. They write one where they blend the two, and it's really interesting because they fill in the years from his youth until he began to preach, and it's not supposition. It's based on historical research of what young men would have done during that period.
Yeah, which is,
it was an interesting book.
Which is largely absent in the Gospels. You know, there's this leap between his youth and then as he begins to preach and his public life. So,
when I read that at the start, they said, this is going to be a stretch. This is going to be a lot of supposition. But when you begin to look at the historical facts of what young men could do based on their whatever tribe they came from, whatever their geographical location, they narrowed down pretty well. So it was interesting reading. So.
The and what's the name of that book, sir?
It's called Jesus, I think I'm saying it right, A Theography.
A Theography.
It's, yeah.
All right. My guest today in the first installment of On Discipline has been the man that was most known for it when I was in the Marine Corps as a lieutenant and a captain, retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General Paul K. Van Riper. What's the K stand for?
Captain. My mother hated nicknames, so she named my twin brother James Keith and named me Paul Kent. And, of course, right away, they come in the Marine Corps, they picked up Rip from me. So,
Well, sir, first of all, again, thank you very much. It's been an honor to have you on the program. And I hope I'd love to have you come back, as I mentioned earlier, and talk about maneuver warfare and get your thoughts on modern-day warfare at a different time. But thank you very much for doing this.
Guys, I look forward to the other because there's a lot of emphasis now on whether warfighting, the Marine Corps Doctrine of Pub 1 needs upgrades or not. And I've got some thoughts on it and some insights.
I'd love to. Well, and again, you were one of the first people that, you know, you put the I and, you know, it used to be C2, Command and Control.
Right.
And then it grew. And then it got an eye in there, and so you were one of the people I think that opened a lot of people's eyes to the future of command and control, and what it would mean for operations and where this whole thing was going. So I would love to do this. So thank you very much for doing this.
Okay, well, appreciate it. I'm always glad to keep my least finger on what's going on in our Corps.
All right, there you have it. That is retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General Paul Van Riper. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. How about that? Yeah, honestly, I want to thank General Van Riper for doing that. The first installment will be a series, and I just think I'd be curious to hear from you if you listen to it. But what a great tool for leaders all across the Marine Corps to learn from, you know, and I'll say this. I mean, I did not understand what he was doing when he was doing it, when he was the CG of the 2nd Division. And I thought I was a pretty smart Marine officer. I just didn't know. I was ignorant. And so if you can imagine the different, as you move the kaleidoscope around and you get General Van Riper's view, and you get General Mattis's view, and you get General Bedard's view, you get General Halleck's view, you get, you know, Sergeant Major X's view, you get Marine Gunner Y's view. I mean, the library that young Marine leaders will have to sit down and listen to and get smart about, and why little things do matter, and the ebb and flow of the Marine Corps as an institution, into wars, out of wars, on the backside of wars, and then in between wars. So I can't thank General Van Riper enough for doing that. And I think if you listen to that, you just sit there and go, wow, that was absolutely, positively fantastic. And again, you know, when you hear him talk about his Vietnam experience and say, you know, all of this, you know, I'm not into, you know, discipline for the sake of appearance. I'm into discipline because it's what wins and it's important. It's important. And when he says, you know, in my year as a company commander, I had 75 Marines killed in action. That's half of a Marine rifle company. I mean, that's a sobering number. And that those lessons come from that. So, cannot say thank you to General Van Riper enough and look forward to sitting down with him and getting his thoughts on the future of maneuver warfare and how he believes maybe there ought to be a few changes to what's being written. So, anywho, thanks for listening to this. And you'll hear more of the On Discipline series right here on All Marine Radio and your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.